from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
It isn't every day that you get a shout out from the President of the United States, but that's what happened to Sister Deidre Byrne. This week on Register Radio, we'll find out why when we talk to the religious sister who was saluted by President Donald Trump. But first, with debates over married clergy in the Amazon region surfacing in the news, we talk to Register contributor Father Carter Griffin, who as rector of Washington's St. John Paul II Seminary, he has a lot to say about the importance of priestly celibacy. I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register. I'm joined by my co-host Matthew Bunsen, who's the senior editor for the Register. The Synod of the Amazon that's going to be held in Rome in October has actually just taken a lot of energy away from the Catholic press lately to talk about something that has been debated time and time again, and that is priestly celibacy. And here we are talking about it again. The Amazon Synod has on its agenda an item to discuss what is called veri probati. And this is where there's a proposal to ordain married men, older married men who have good record in their lives, to the priesthood. And this has caused a lot of discussion. And we have with us for this segment Father Carter Griffin. As I said, he is the rector of St. John Paul Seminary in Washington, D.C., and he's a Register columnist. He's written a book very recently called Why Celibacy? Reclaiming the Fatherhood of the Priest. Father Carter Griffin, welcome.
Thanks so much. Great to be here with you.
So it's been great to have you writing in the Register at this time. I mean, the Synod is coming up, but you also have a book coming out on this very topic. Were the two timed together?
Well, sort of. I mean, I think there has been, as you said earlier, this is not a new thing that's being discussed. It's maybe it sort of has peaks and valleys, you know, in history. And I think we're reaching one of those peaks where we're looking at this hard again. And frankly, I think it's a good thing to look at it hard again, because I think there's so many beautiful aspects of celibacy that need to be highlighted once again. So it was in light of the upcoming Synod, but it was also just in light of kind of the general malaise in the church, some of the scandals, the kind of the awareness of the shortage of priests. And I think in my experience, anecdotally, speaking to a lot of even very wonderful, faithful Catholics, I think a lot of folks are starting to lose confidence in it. And so I wanted to look at the other side of the story. Well, why do we have it, and why should we be very careful about taking down a wall until we know why it was put up?
Absolutely. I mean, let's go ahead and dive in. I mean, you wrote a wonderful piece for the Register a few weeks ago. We printed it in the July 7th print edition, so it's in readers' hands now. And it was also posted online at our website. And it was called The Beauty of Priestly Celibacy. And I have to say, a lot of people these days may not see it as beautiful. So why that title, and why call it beautiful?
Well, I mean, I think it's beautiful because it's a great gift to the man himself, but more importantly, it's a great gift to the church in many ways. But I would sort of zero in on a couple of things. One of them, as you mentioned, the book and the title, "The Reclaiming the Fatherhood of the Priest." All of us are called to give life in different ways, and celibacy is kind of a mode. It's a channel for a way of human loving in grace that can enable a man or a woman for religious celibacy to give life in a very powerful way, and their kind of moral and approachable availability, and their life of prayer, which overflows into preaching, and their capacity to give, their availability to give everything they have to their people. There's a real wideness to a celibate's heart, which, you know, would be lost, and it is lost for, you know, it's much harder for someone who's both married and a priest, and certainly we have some of those. The Orthodox Church certainly has them as well. But there are two sort of total vocations which are very, very difficult to juggle sometimes. So I think that's one. I think the other thing that's very important about celibacy that would be lost is that it is a very powerful and very beautiful witness to the love of God and to the reality of God, the sort of the supernatural reality. You know, I walk around in my Roman collar, and sort of like it or not, I'm kind of a challenge, you know, to people. Right. It's like, this is a man who's given himself, and clearly, either God exists or he doesn't, but he's thrown it all, you know, on one side of the court. And it can be a very beautiful kind of witness for people, I think.
Well, you've recently written for the Register, and I want to quote this, that celibacy is an existential threat to the sexual ideology of our time. It is a reminder that true love is found not primarily in sexual activity, but in the life of charity which unites us to God and to one another. So in a way, have we lost that true understanding of sexuality?
Well, I think it has been sort of trivialized many times in the post-sort of sexual revolutionary culture that we live in. That on the one hand, it seems like people have kind of idolized sexuality, and on the other hand, it just seems like it's been completely trivialized, you know, and sort of it just becomes kind of another sort of mode for recreational pleasure. And I think what celibacy is it's saying that all of us are called to love, and for some it's going to include sexual love and marriage, but all of us are called to love, and all of that love, including the sexual love, the beautiful sexual love between a husband and a wife, has a still higher ordering. There's something even more beautiful than that in itself, and that is it orders us to God and to each other in this very powerful sort of communion of persons. And without celibacy, we do live in a fallen world, and we can easily lapse back into kind of that more shallow view of sexuality. So I think that there's a complementarity between the marriage and the celibate vocations. Each of them strengthens the other. And there's something about celibacy that is, I think, a very powerful witness to married couples, too, in that regard.
You know, I really love what you said a few minutes ago about the wide heart. You know, it's just that there's more space for availability. Yeah. And I have three kids, and they're young at this point in time. And they consume a lot of time and energy and love, of course, for my husband and me. And so I can understand very well right now in this moment, a challenging moment with, such small kids, what you mean by that wide heart. And that's really a beautiful description, I think. I think that could be attractive if it was spoken more, if more people understood it in that context. I mean, so many people understand it as is giving up or a prohibition, let's say, on sexual pleasure, you know, and on sexual activity. But it's so much more than that. And you've really verbalized that. I want to bring into the discussion the seminarians that you have spent so much time with for the last, I think it, I read 2011, you've been working with vocations and seminarians and now as rector. So how do you talk to your seminarians about this issue and what are the challenges to them?
Well, you know, I think before one can receive and live the vocation, the charism, and it is a charism, it's a gift from God, this charism of celibacy. Our Lord speaks about it in St. Matthew's Gospel, and it's not for everyone, he says. You know, and so part of this is discerning that and learning how to live it. But before that, they first have to learn sort of the ordinary path of discipleship, which every Christian has to learn, and that includes the virtue of chastity, which every person, married and single, has to be able to live, this sort of self control is self-mastery, which enables us. It's not a self-mastery of kind of prohibitions and kind of closing in on oneself, but it's precisely the opposite. It's the self-mastery that which enables us to channel our love well, and whatever our vocation might be, and that entails a certain amount of discipline. And it's, you know, they're coming from the same culture that we're all living in, and so there's a lot of temptations out there. Mm-hmm. There's more access and availability of things that draw us away from that that powerful capacity to give ourselves. So the first step is kind of making sure that everyone really grows in that virtue of chastity, that capacity to give. And then from there, there's a kind of, there's an openness of heart, there's an openness of mind, which, you know, they're in the seminary. I find them, I don't know if I can name a single seminarian who would, like, actively wants the church to change her teaching on celibacy, you know, or almost any young priest, for that matter, which is a surprise to a lot of people. I think a lot of folks think that we're somehow kind of been straitjacketed into this, kind of this is the tax for becoming a priest, is you got to give up a wife. And that's just not how we see it. I mean, it's a life full of love and full of joy, and not a dry and reclusive life, unless we want it to be, you know? Right. And I think what people need to see is not just hear about the beauty of celibacy, but see it lived in a beautiful way in their own parish priest. And I think most do. I think oftentimes people will say, well, I have a problem with celibacy, or I have a problem with this, that, and the other thing, but of course, not my priest. People have often a very good experience of their own priest. Well, that's pretty universal. I'd say, you know, many priests, most priests, and certainly most young priests, I think, see the beauty of this vocation or are living it really well. So trying to instill that love in the hearts of these young seminarians, but they're certainly receptive.
Absolutely. And you know what you're saying, is, it is also confirmed by statistics, in fact. I mean, when you interview younger priests or newly ordained, I should say, because not all of them are very young, they mm-hmm. say that that example is often what led them to the priesthood, so the example of a priest and the support of that person. So yeah, what you're saying by your anecdotal experience is it weighs out with the evidence of statistics. I want to turn. We don't have much time, just a few minutes, but I wanted to turn to the debate that is today. And you say in your latest piece, "What the Debate on Celibacy Gets Wrong," mm-hmm. is part of the title. And why? What's going wrong right now in this debate on celibacy? Why is it the wrong approach?
Well, it seems to me that that maybe not universally, but often when I talk to people about optional celibacy, what they're really speaking about is an understanding of the priesthood, which has been kind of diminished down to a kind of functionary. You know, somebody who comes in, offers the sacraments, or maybe just sometimes offers Mass and kind of goes and does it in another place. And I'm not saying that's necessarily the motive of everyone who's, but I think it can often kind of implicitly sort of fill that discussion. And so it seems to me that before we can really kind of tackle the question of married clergy and optional celibacy and all that stuff, we need to first understand what the priesthood is, you know. And the priesthood, it seems to me, and I think it seems to the Church and the Church's documents, is really primarily about giving life as a spiritual father. And I think rather than tampering with the celibacy, what might be a better approach to some of these areas of the world that are in such great need of priests is to really focus on the re-flourishing, the renewal of the lay life there, of the Church's life there, and building a strong Catholic culture and strong families. And that's where you're going to get, that's where you're really going to get the holy, generous priest that we need for the future. You know, the Church started with just 12 priests, and one of them was immediately, you know, betrayed our Lord. It was a very small right. group, and yet they, with dynamism and love, did, you know, converted the world. And that's, I think we need to return to that more supernatural outlook of the priesthood and of the Church.
Well, you have given me a lot of hope, because it's such a refreshing way to look at the priesthood. It's so good to hear about the young seminarians and what their, you know, what their view is. And so we hope to talk a little bit more about this, because I think right now the priesthood is getting, we just have such a bad image of the priesthood because of scandal. And so thank you, right. Father Griffin, for your witness and for the work that you're doing, and blessings on the start of a new school year.
Thank you, Jeanette. And thank you so much for having me on. But above all, I would ask you and our listeners, you know, to really just pray for these young men. They're exceptional young men, but, you know, they're getting battered about like everybody else.
Absolutely.
And so that they would stay strong and become good holy priests.
Absolutely. Well, we love to pray for vocations and for young priests and priests, all priests, I should say. So thanks a lot.
God bless you, Jeanette. Thank you. Thanks, Matthew.
When we come back, Matthew and I talk to Sister Deidre Byrne about her uniforms. Three uniforms: surgeon's scrubs, a soldier's camouflage, and a sister's habit. And her shout out from President Trump. This is Register Radio. More when we return.
Have you heard who's reading the Register? Why, it's Matthew Bunsen.
The National Catholic Register is that rarest of institutions in Catholic media, striving always to be faithful, orthodox, timely, and dedicated to journalistic excellence. Catholics know they can always depend on the Register for the news they need to know from an authentically Catholic perspective.
For a 3-month free subscription to the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 3 months free banner. Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
From our earliest days, Americans of faith have uplifted our nation. This evening, we're joined by Sister Deidre Byrne. Sister Byrne is a retired Army surgeon who served for nearly 30 years. On September 11th, 2001, the sister raced to Ground Zero. Through smoke and debris, she administered first aid and comfort to all. Today, Sister Byrne runs a medical clinic serving the poor in our nation's capital. Sister, thank you for your lifetime of service. Thank you.
That's President Trump saluting a religious sister during his 4th of July Salute to America speech at the Lincoln Memorial. Sister Deirdre Byrne of the Little Workers of the Sacred Heart of Jesus and Mary joins us now. Sister Dee Dee, Sister Dee Dee, what was it like? You were among a list of people, past and present, American citizens who've been saluted, people like Clara Barton, the founder of the American Red Cross, and firefighters, first responders, sheriffs, all of these people. You were listed among them as someone who has made America a better place. What was it like to be sitting there and to hear that from President Trump?
Well, it was a bit of a shocker. I mean, I looked around to see if he was really talking about me because I don't see myself that way. But
it was a total surprise. It was a total surprise?
It was a surprise. I mean, I knew I'd been invited by the White House to come, and actually I did my best to get out of it only because I have so much on my plate. But I was told by the young lady that it was really important that I show up, and I did want to support the president because he's done so much to support life, and so I just felt God wanted me there at that time.
Wow. Wow. So what a blessing to have that that recognition of the service that you've done. And that service has not only been as a religious sister. Our blogger, Kathy Schiffer, who writes at the Register and who's really actually just won a wonderful award for her writing. She talked with you this week, and she wrote about your history and your biography, and her piece is titled "Trump Just Gave a Shout-Out to Sister Deirdre Byrne." Who is she? Three uniforms,
yes.
A surgeon's uniform, a soldier's camouflage, and now a sister's habit. So you've had these three segments in your life, all of service, really.
Sometime at the same time.
Really? So that's what I want to know.
Yeah, I was active duty at the same time I was a religious sister.
Are you kidding me?
And I could have only done that because of our community was so supportive of what had occurred, you know, when Two Towers fell and the Pentagon was hit and the world had changed in September 11th, 2001. And I told Kathy Schiffer that, you know, our sister, our community is Italian-based. We founded in 1894. Many of our sisters were living in the southern part of Italy when the U.S. came and basically freed us from, freed the Italians from German occupation during the Second World War. And so they had a great fondness and support for the military.
Mm-hmm. So they It sounds like your community has a civic service as part of what your community is about. It sounds from that history.
Yeah, well, service just to those who are really in need. That was what our founder wanted. And at that time, you know, it wasn't really a written commitment per se, but because I was a general surgeon and I was transitioning into the little workers, and then when the towers fell and they called me and asked me to serve, I was working in a hospital backing up Walter Reed at the time, mm-hmm. as a reservist, and was in the process of, you know, phasing out to become a little worker when all this happened. And so they had given me so much, meaning the military, because they put me through, I went through an Army scholarship at Georgetown. So I've received so much that I was excited to be able to give back. And what greater group, you know, next to the poor. I say I'm really blessed because I got to take care of the two greatest, you know, the poor and our soldiers who are
Absolutely.
Always in harm's way.
Absolutely. What a beautiful witness and a beautiful life of service. So it sounds to me from what I read with Kathy's piece, which was really a great piece, everyone should read it. What it sounds to me is you had, you perceived your vocation to be one of service through medical work and through the military. How did you become a religious sister?
Well, that calling was from the beginning, and it, you know, I'm one of eight kids, and my mom, mothers know their children the best, and she always said I had a vocation in utero, and a religious vocation. So as a little kid, I was always attracted to that type of life, you know, reading books that were related to that. And then my father is a thoracic, well, God rest his soul, he was a thoracic surgeon. He was also a wonderful role model. Both my parents, by the way, were our daily mass goers. Great example of married life and whatnot. But so I asked the Lord if he got me in to med school, I would be his doctor. Mm. And in the beginning, because Dad was putting us all in through college, grad school, whatever, and I was 5 of the 8. Some were already in college, some in grad school. I heard the you know, the call for you know, serving in the military, you know, free tuition. So I signed on the dotted line, not knowing really what I was doing, but it turned out in the long run to be a great experience.
So let me confirm something. You knew from the beginning you were going to be a religious, but you had also the sense that God was calling you to be a doctor for him. And then you got it paid for by going into the military. That's brilliant.
Right. But in my beginning, I went into family medicine first, okay, because it really is a good way to do missionary. I always kind of envisioned myself working in some mission hospital overseas somewhere, mm-hmm, and as a religious sister. And I get to do that still, but not to the extent I had envisioned in those earlier years. But after my family medicine residency and I paid back Uncle Sam,
yes,
I did missionary work for a year. And then I was blessed and then followed my real heart, which was surgery. So did the surgical residency. And during that time of my surgical training, I was blessed to be the chief resident who scrubbed in on the case with Cardinal Hickey on his open heart surgery. So I was there, you know, holding his pulsatile heart as the heart surgeon was doing the bypass. And, you know, I harvested his veins in the lower extremities, cracked his chest open and closed him up. And then I managed him postoperatively in the ICU. And during that time, and it was a little bit rocky, he was very good. And he became my spiritual friend, in a sense. No matter where I was, he was always keeping in touch with me. You know, and then I also had the opportunity to meet Mother Teresa at that time, who was really, she and another religious sister from a different community, Sister Frederick, were two instruments in my life that gave me a role models, in a sense. And Mother Teresa was really in high school I'd heard about her and read every book and saw every movie on her life. And that's what I wanted to do, is to be able to give free loving care to the poor. I thought it would be as a missionary of charity, but it turned out that God had different plans.
Right.
So, because I had met, when Mother was in town, I met with Father John Harden, who's a wonderful, he's a Jesuit who's died now, but he wrote all the catechetical works for the Missionaries of Charity to do street-side catechesis. And he sat down with me and said, if you have been given a gift of medicine and you really need to use it, you know, completely.
Absolutely.
So the little workers were very open to that.
It's wonderful. You know, I have to jump in here because as I'm listening to this, mm-hmm, and I'm listening to how God guided you along the way, not only do you have a gift for medicine, but it sounds to me like you have a wonderful gift of discernment to know where God is calling. And that's something that's so lost today. I don't have much time left in this part of the show, mm-hmm, but what's your advice to young people who are seeking to listen to what God's will is? How can they learn to hear?
I think before the Blessed Sacrament, you know, the founder of the Little Workers, now Blessed Francesco Maria Greco, said, it was before the Blessed Sacrament that I found the love of Jesus and the power of that love. And I tried to make every decision before the Blessed Sacrament, using the Ignatian, you know, what, you know, the pros and cons, or what would give God the greater the glory, what would not, and, you know, just spend very, you know, short time discerning that. And I also had, you know, Cardinal Hickey guiding me. I had Sister Philip Marie Burley, who's in the Midwest. She was guiding me in those earlier years. And I always went to my parents. Mm. I mean, my mother and father, before I made any decision, I would sit with them and share with them and say, this is what I think God wants me to do. And so that I wasn't, you know, going off the train tracks, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely.
What? And so before the Eucharist, the young people should, you know, take away all the electronics and just sit before the Blessed Sacrament, even if it's for 5 minutes, and just write down the things that are important to them and the pros and cons of each decision. And I did that almost every step of the way. And even though when I was in the Army, I was accepted to Tripler Army, the surgical residency, it's like the Harvard of the Army. I decided not to take that, even though a lot of people had gone out of their way to help me get there, because I felt God was calling me more to the religious life, more than the military or mm-hmm. medical. Lo and behold, though, here I am. There I was, continuing on. God has a great, great plan. So, and that I would not have met Mother Teresa at the level I did, nor Cardinal Hickey. So I could see the pluses. No, there's never really any bad decision. There's a good decision. I mean, if you do it with prayer before the Blessed Sacrament, but there's a good decision and a greater decision.
Absolutely.
And God will make good out of anything and make it great.
As long
as you keep your eyes on the cross and to follow His will as best you can.
Well, it's wonderful. What a wonderful witness, and I appreciate you sharing your story with us, and your story continues, so we'll join you in prayer to support your vocation and all those that you touch. Thank you very much, Sister.
Thank you. Thank you for the time. I appreciate that.
Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, and of course to read about Sister Dee Dee, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us on Register Radio here on EWTN. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless you.